you suffer from chronic CFED or can't focus energy drain? Try over-the-counter Vibrin. One tablet contains the same caffeine as a cup of coffee, but without the calories or coffee breath. Vibrin, caffeine, not coffee. Taking Vibrin may result in a lack of drowsiness, improved productivity, and better cash flow from decreased coffee spending. Unexpected job promotions have been associated with Vibrin. Vibrin may decrease the urge to zone out, doze off, or exhibit signs of slacking. All jokes aside, always read the label, take only as directed, and limit caffeine as it may cause real side effects. Not for children under age 12.
Hi, Suzanne L. Key here. Thank you for joining me for another fact-filled episode on Suzanne Live Talk. Where else but blogtalkradio.com, broadcasting live from Southern California every Saturday night at 8 p.m. It's all right here with me, Suzanne L. Key. Go to blogtalkradio.com/Suzanne Live. Good evening, and welcome back for another fact-filled episode on Suzette Live Talk. I'm Suzette LT. Have you ever wondered, I know I have, about some of the other BTR shows? They don't quite announce their hosts' names. Sometimes you're left to find out during the show when a caller calls in, or, you know, maybe, I don't know, if it's mentioned in the chat room. I just found that odd. I always like to announce who I am so that you can address me if you need to, either on the phone or through the chat. Anyway, I just thought I would bring that up, something I noticed. It's December 9th, 2017, and this evening's program is discussing the Benghazi story behind the story. And we all have our ideas of what happened from what we get from media sources. Of course, we all also know that media doesn't quite give everything that we need to have in order to paint a complete picture. There's still a lot of unanswered questions. At least I know for me. We've had a lot of tragedies concerning our embassies. We've lost men and women. And we've also lost women and men here on our own soil as well. Chief from Simple Facts of Life says, I always announce my incognito identity. Yes, you do. You do. You're one of the few that does. And Donnie C. does too, as a matter of fact. I do recall. But there are quite a few out there that do not. I just found that interesting. Anyway, so tonight I thought what I had learned I would share with you that wasn't reported in the media. So an in-depth look at Benghazi. Let's see here. We have Judicial Watch, who's an organization that had conducted their own independent investigation, and another organization by the name of the Citizens Commission on Benghazi. Now, the two groups independently concluded or conducted an investigation and then put their conclusions in separate reports. The Citizen Commission on Benghazi, they worked with a group called Accuracy in Media. And at the time, they were taking the lead in reporting the truth about Benghazi that Republicans wouldn't even touch as far as reporting to their constituents, which is us. I mean, they interviewed witnesses, collected documents. There were people on the committee that were actually there on the ground during the event. Their goal was to answer why it happened, how it happened, and why it was covered up. So let's begin with the step-by-step, how Hillary and Obama incubated ISIS. By piecing together recently revealed WikiLeaks emails with evidence that has emerged over the past several years, it's become increasingly clear that President Obama and his Secretary of State at the time, Hillary Clinton, in 2011, armed the Free Syrian Army rebels in an effort to topple the regime of Bashar al-Assad. mirroring a strategy already underway in Libya to help al-Qaeda-affiliated militia overthrow Muammar Gaddafi. A consequence of the strategy was the emergence of ISIS. They were out of the loosely coordinated Free Syrian Army coalition, as well as the disastrous Benghazi attack in which a U.S. ambassador was murdered. Various WikiLeaks emails examined by WND indicate the Free Syrian Army was among the first splinter rebel groups Clinton and Obama armed. The Obama administration apparently was hoping to replicate the regime's change strategy in which it armed al-Qaeda-affiliated militia in Libya, including Ansar al-Sharia, the group responsible for the September 11, 2012 attack at Benghazi. Now, these things weren't reported in the media, and we all know why. Barack Obama was up for re-election, and he couldn't have the American people know what he was up to. Now, the Obama administration's betrayal is exposed in See Something, Say Nothing. A Homeland Security officer exposes the government's submission to jihad by former DHS officer Philip Haney, a WND editor, Art Moore. As WND reported last week, which this was the week of January of this year, how about that? So we're still learning things. So what was reported this year, a few months ago, was the Turkish president, Tayyip Erdogan, his assertion that U.S.-led coalition forces have given support to terror groups, including ISIS in Syria. Now, the claim derived further support from a recording leaked to the New York Times of Secretary of State John Kerry admitting the Obama administration not only hoped ISIS would dispose the Assad regime, it also gave arms to the jihadist army and its allies to carry out the task. That wasn't reported in the news. Hacked emails to Hillary Clinton from longtime advisor Sidney Blumenthal that were published in October by WikiLeaks tells the story. On June 20th, 2011, Blumenthal sent a confidential email to Clinton at the State Department that included an article by David W. Lesh, a professor of Middle Eastern history at Trinity University in San Antonio. Lesh argued a strategy of regime change could be effected in Syria if the U.S. could find opposition groups in Syria capable of establishing a Benghazi-like refuge from which to launch a rebellion and to which aid can be sent. You see the picture kind of building here? That could possibly be why the so-called embassy was a makeshift embassy. It might as well have been a cardboard box. In a subsequent confidential email, July 24, 2012, Blumenthal further advised Clinton that the growing success of the rebel forces of the Free Syria Army, caused him to believe the Assad regime was increasingly vulnerable to being toppled. And then in another email, February 24th, 2012, Blumenthal characterized the FSA as loosely organized and uncoordinated, noting it was for the most part local militias, many of them civilian-based, that are simply calling themselves the FSA to appear to be a part of a whole. Blumenthal commented in the email that the armed resistance to Assad is not well-funded or well-armed. On February 28, 2012, Jacob Sullivan, a State Department senior policy advisor to Secretary Clinton, forwarded to Clinton an opinion piece published in the New York Times by foreign correspondent Roger Cohen, suggesting the strategy Obama and Clinton had used to topple Gaddafi in Libya should be used to bring down Assad in Syria. As the Bosnian War showed, the basis for any settlement must be a rough equality of forces. So I say, step up the efforts already quietly ongoing to get some weapons to the Free Syrian Army. Train those forces just as the rebels were trained in Libya, Cohen wrote. Payback time has come around. The United States warned Assad about allowing al-Qaeda fighters to transit Syria to Iraq. That's my dog. Now material in the special forces with the ability to train a ragtag army can transit Iraq and other neighboring states into Syria. Then on September 18, 2012, 1 week after the Benghazi terror attack, Blumenthal, in a confidential memo, alerted Clinton to the possibility of the FSA military taking over Damascus. The prospect caused Assad's wife and close relatives to urge Assad to flee Syria to avoid the fate of Assad's former ally, Muammar al-Gaddafi of Libya, who was captured and killed by rebel forces while attempting to flee his home territory in Sirte. Clinton sought to arm Free Syrian Army. In August 17, 2014, an email released by WikiLeaks said, Clinton, after her services as Secretary of State, suggested to advisors John Podesta, at the time, we should return to plans to provide the FSA, Free Syrian Army, that's what the FSA is, with some group of moderate forces, with equipment that will allow them to deal with a weakened ISIL, and stepped up operations against the Syrian regime. Now, Andrew C. McCarthy, a senior policy fellow at the National Review Institute, tied the statement to the Obama administration's plan to equip Syrian fighters, either the False Syrian Army or other moderate forces, to a U.S.-led operation in coordination with Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey to steer up weapons to Syria, ostensibly to fight both Assad and ISIS. McCarthy noted, however, that Clinton 2014 memo to Podesta asserted the Saudis and Qatari governments both supported ISIS and other radical Sunni groups. In September 2013, WND reported Secretary of State John Kerry and Senator John McCain, Republican from Arizona, had relied on the work of Elizabeth O. Baggy, a 26-year-old graduate student, to argue in testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that Obama administration should send weapons to arm the moderate Free Syrian Army to oppose the Assad government in Syria. In that article, WND detailed the extensive lobbying efforts conducted in Washington to advance the Free Syrian Army as a moderate group, despite clear evidence that all Al-Nusra Front, operating under the Free Syrian umbrella, had been declared a terrorist organization by the State Department and pledged allegiance to Al-Qaeda's top leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri, and was a group of choice for foreign jihadi fighters pouring into Syria. So here they're trying to arm people who clearly should not have any of our weapons in their hands. And yet we have John McCain, who put this 26-year-old up there and said, argue the point that, yes, we need to do this. We need to do this. McCain. Okay, so the April 22nd, 2014 report, How America Changed Sides in the War on Terror, alleges the U.S. was fully aware of and facilitating the delivery of weapons to the al-Qaeda-dominated rebel militias throughout the 2011 rebellion. There was a report by the Citizens Commission titled, How America Changed Sides in the War on Terror. And that's exactly how they did, because basically now we're on the side of terrorists by arming them. Go figure. So the rebels made no secret of their al-Qaeda affiliation, openly flying and speaking in front of the black flag of Islamic Jihad, according to author John Rosenthal, and multiple media reports. The interim report said, and yet the White House and the senior congressional members deliberately and knowingly pursued a policy that provided material support to terrorist organizations in order to topple a ruler who had been working closely with the West actively to suppress Al-Qaeda. The report concluded, the result in Libya, across much of North Africa and beyond, has been utter chaos. Disruption of Libya's oil industry, the spread of dangerous weapons, including surface-to-air missiles, and the empowerment of the jihadist organization like Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood. The report identified a key Al-Qaeda operative who played a major role moving U.S. arms into both Libya and Syria. As Abdul Hakim Bahalji, a.k.a. Abdullah A. Al-Sadek, let me say that again, Abdullah Al-Sadek, and Bahalji was a veteran jihad fighter of Iraq and Afghanistan, commander of the Al-Qaeda franchise militia. Libya Islamic Fighting Group, a.k.a. Libyan Islamic Movement for Change, a post-revolution military commander of Tripoli, and the Libyan delegation leader to the Free Syrian Army in late 2011. So here we have Mrs. Clinton and Barack Obama and John McCain and John Kerry and our congressional government as well, all in this and knowing this. And this explains a lot in the sense that Trey Gowdy, when appointed select committee to investigate Benghazi, came out of that investigation saying that there was nothing to look at. Everything was on the up and up, and he couldn't see any reason to go on further. And that's because he knew, they all knew, that they were aware of what had gone on and even okayed it, signed off on siding with terrorists. And these terrorists, of course, got out of hand. They're terrorists, for goodness sake. What do you expect? You didn't really think that you could control them, did you? Apparently they did. So now we're going to go on to the Citizens Commission on Benghazi final report. Now, this final report is very detailed into the actions that occurred. It has a table of contents, their key findings, executive summary, betraying an ally in the global war on terror, running guns to Al-Qaeda, Libya's descent into chaos and warnings ignored, the emergency plan, the CIA annex, Zero Footprint 2.0, the AEGIS group, Blue Mountain and Mission Security, warnings ignored, the gathering storm, the attack unfolds, the rescue that never came, files from Benghazi in the hands of Al-Qaeda, a cover-up that revealed everything, talking points, the White House attack on free speech, orchestrated assault on free speech at the UN, and their conclusion. So it covers quite a lot. So let's go start with, they have a foreword here. When we at Accuracy in Media decided to form the Citizens Commission on Benghazi, also known as the CCB, to independently investigate the full set of circumstances surrounding the attacks in Benghazi on September 11, 2012 that killed four Americans, we had no idea what the journey would be like. After initially reaching out to several retired senior military officers, who all immediately said yes, we continued with their help to assemble an all-star team of people who believed had the wisdom, experience, contacts, and integrity to help Americans learn the truth about what happened there. AIM has been involved in numerous stories involving America, America's national security since our founding in 1969, by Reed Irving, a former Marine intelligence officer in World War II who later became an economist with the Federal Reserve in Washington. AIM corrected the record on the Vietnam War with a documentary that aired on PBS. We spent years battling the Washington establishment and both parties to bring out the truth about American POW MIAs. We exposed the lies in the CNN Time magazine story on Operation Tailwind and answered the tough questions on how we got into the 2003 Iraq War. AIM has long assumed the role of warriors for truth and advocates for honest journalism without fear of favor. Why Benghazi? We view these attacks as a sort of Rosetta Stone, revealing much about the ideology and disposition of the Barack Obama administration. It wasn't just that the administration failed to secure our diplomatic mission or overcome the aid of Americans sent there in harm's way. It was a much broader narrative. We watched the story unfold just 2 months before a presidential election and saw the media botch the story, providing cover for Obama as he headed toward re-election. Congress and the State Department appointed accountability review board seemed to be intent on obscuring the truth rather than exposing it. In the meantime, our colleagues at Special Operation Speaks, SOS, primed the investigative pumps via Rep. Frank Wolf, Republican from Virginia, presenting to the U.S. Congress and to Speaker Boehner a petition signed by nearly 1,000 Special Operations veterans demanding a joint select committee to investigate Benghazi. SOS soon became a contributing member of the CCB. With a question we at AIM often ask ourselves before deciding on a course of action, what would Reed Irving do? We decided it was time to act. We started out with a press conference in July 2013, followed by 2 months later, an all-day conference that was webcast live and later posted on our website, featuring the congressman who was leading the call for a select committee, Judicial Watch, which was already at work filling Freedom of Information requests, Charles Woods, the father of one of the brave Americans killed in the attacks, nearly all of the CCB members, and others with an interest in the story. Okay, so let's go on to the key findings of the betrayal in Benghazi, a dereliction of duty. I don't think they're in any particular order because they're bulleted, so I'll just begin at the top. The Obama administration actively supported the replacement of quasi-secular North African rulers in Tanzania, Libya, and Egypt with Muslim Brotherhood rule. Next, in Libya, the Obama administration turned against Muammar Gaddafi, who had become an ally in the fight against the global jihad movement, and instead worked with the Libyan Muslim Brotherhood and materially aided known Al-Qaeda-linked militia to topple his regime. How about that one? Next, the Obama administration throughout 2012 deliberately withheld urgently requested security for the U.S. mission in Benghazi, at least in part to buttress the false narrative, that Al-Qaeda had been defeated for the benefit of the president's reelection campaign in 2012, despite the fact that Benghazi was one of the most vulnerable U.S. posts anywhere in the world in the volatile post-Qaddafi environment. Next, for reasons not entirely clear, multiple advance warnings about an impending attack against the U.S. mission in Benghazi were ignored by the Obama administration as a whole. The Department of Defense specifically, and also especially Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who bore ultimate responsibility for the diplomatic mission security. Next, despite an egregious failure by the Pentagon to pre-position forces in advance, various U.S. assets were available to deploy immediately when the Benghazi attack began, the night of September 11, 2012, but were held back from even attempting to rescue. the President, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, former Secretary of Defense Pineda, and General Martin E. Dempsey, former Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, must be required to answer for their dereliction of duty. Willfully refusing to perform one's duty, a criminal offense under the United States Code, in failing to provide appropriate protection in advance, and to commit forces immediately to a rescue attempt the night of 11-12 September 2012. The Obama White House and Clinton State Department led a concerted two-week cover-up regarding the facts of the Benghazi attack for cross-political purposes and to collaborate with the international campaign led by Organization of Islamic Cooperation that seeks criminalization of all criticism of Islam. So let's see. That's it for their key findings. And we all know pretty much a lot of that already. I want to get into the nitty gritty here. I read through this. It's 78 pages long, which you could say isn't too long, but you know, when you're reading it aloud to other people, it can be long. I don't want to bore you too much. So we know about the betraying ally. Okay, let's skip over to betraying the ally and why, because I know a lot of people aren't quite sure. They know it had to do with gold. Some people say oil. So let's get the skinny on that. Discerning analysts have long questioned why the Obama administration decided that violent intervention was necessary in Libya. It will be recalled that Libyan strongman Muammar Gaddafi stunned the world with his 19 December 2003 announcement that he was giving up all his weapons of mass destruction programs and inviting international inspectors to verify that commitment. He subsequently agreed to end all military dealings with Iran, North Korea, and Syria, renounced all support for terrorism, and reestablished full diplomatic relations with the U.S. in May 2006. U.S. trust in Gaddafi's support for what was then called the Global War on Terror was such that in 2007, Abu Sufyan bin Kamau, a key al-Qaeda terrorist, was released from Guantanamo Bay detention and sent to Libya, where Gaddafi duly jailed him. Bin Kamau had trained in one of Osama bin Laden's camps in Afghanistan and later worked for bin Laden's company in Sudan before fighting alongside the Taliban by 2008. However, bin Laden or bin Kamau was sent out, among the first of unknown Libyan jihadists to be released in reconciliation, a process led by Gaddafi's son, Sharif al-Islam, former Libyan Islamic fighter group, member of the Abd Hakim Beljihadi, also was released from Libyan incarceration in 2008. Later, Bin Kamau would find Ansar al-Sharia in Derna, and his forces would participate in the deadly 2012 Benghazi attacks. Christopher Stevens named U.S. envoy to the Libyan al-Qaeda and Muslim Brotherhood rebels in early 2011, coordinated closely with Belhaji throughout 2011, despite knowing that Belhaji and the LIFG, which is the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, had been connected to al-Qaeda for years. Yet despite Gaddafi's seemingly modeled behavior regarding his renunciation of the weapons of mass destruction and support for the GWOT, when al-Qaeda's Muslim Brotherhood and various tribal elements rose up and revolt against Gaddafi regime in February 2011, Obama administration abruptly abandoned that relationship and instead sided with the jihadist rebels. Neither the U.S. Intelligence Committee nor the military agreed with Obama-Clinton decision to invade Libya, nor was that military action ever approved by U.S. Congress. Clinton emails, now public, document clearly that she knew that Al-Qaeda in Libya and the Libyan Muslim Brotherhood were working closely together to bring down Gaddafi's regime. For example, February 27, 2011, email from Clinton aide Jake Sullivan describes Ali al-Salababi, the founder of the AQ-linked Libyan National Party, also known as the LNP, and a longtime close associate of the LIFG, which, if you remember from just a moment ago, was the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. So, excuse me, that associate commander, as a key figure in the Libyan Muslim Brotherhood and Muslim Brotherhood leader, Sheikh Yusuf Qaradawi's man in Libya. So, Al-Qaradawi, she's had issued a fatwa calling for the killing of Gaddafi on 22nd February 2011. Muammar Gaddafi's son, Saif Gaddafi, called Ali al-Salababi, the spiritual leader of the Libyan Revolution, while the Wall Street Journal described al-Salababi's role in channeling military aid from Qatar to the Libyan al-Qaeda fighters as central. From the al-Qaeda's plan timeline to an Islamic caliphate published in 2005, we read that the fourth phase was planned to take place between 2010 and 2013, when al-Qaeda will aim to bring both the collapse of the hated Arabic Islamic uprising across North Africa, began with the Tanzania in December 2010, and had spread to Egypt and Libya by February 2011. It is incontrovertible that Obama's administration's decision to back the Muslim Brotherhood in these countries contributed significantly to the jihadist power grab and the chaos that followed. Clues about why Obama and Clinton, strongly supported by then U.S. Ambassador to the United States Susan Rice and Samantha Power, then serving at the National Security Council, would betray a leader like Gaddafi, who seemingly done everything asked of him by the Western powers. They emerged from some of the 3,000 emails released by the State Department from her private server in late December 2015. Nearly a third of those emails reportedly were from close Clinton confidant Sidney Blumenthal, whose correspondence included a number of messages providing all kinds of advice and information about Libya with former CIA officer Tyler Drumheller, who died in 2015. How about that? I don't say what he died of. Among that correspondence were messages which Blumenthal repeatedly urged Clinton to intervene in Libya. For one thing, Sidney Blumenthal and others apparently had some ideas about post-Gaddafi business deals in Libya. According to Benghazi Select Committee Chairman Trey Gowdy, Blumenthal's reveal motivation was money, and specifically a deal to bring U.S. defense contractor Osprey Global Solutions in, which Blumenthal held a personal stake, together with the Muslim Brotherhood-dominated Libyan Transitional National Council government in post-Gaddafi Libya. Oh my goodness, that's crazy. Europeans, especially the French, also looked at the Libyan situation through financial lenses. Some of them saw Gaddafi's growing financial independence as a threat to their own financial interests. One of the Blumenthal emails, dated April 2, 2011, discusses Gaddafi's stockpiles of gold and silver, valued at more than $7 billion. Reportedly, this wealth has to have been used to establish a pan-African currency based on the Libyan golden dinar. Plan was designated to provide the Francophone African countries with an alternative to the French franc, in a bid to supplant France and the dominant power in Francophone Africa. In 2011, French President Nicolas Sarkozy called the Libyan leader and Libya's reported plan to quit selling oil in U.S. dollars, a threat to the financial security of the world. What happened to Gaddafi's gold and silver stocks after his defeat has not been disclosed. In addition to Gaddafi's apparent bid to establish a pan-African hard currency outside the U.S. dollar system, he'd actually been demonstrating the possibility for financial independence with the construction of the Great Man-Made River Project, a massive system of pipes that supplied water to the Saharan Libya from the Nubian sandstone aquifer. And we're going to continue with that in just a moment. We're going to take a quick break here. We're going to get some water, get yourself something to drink, and we'll be right back.
We were misled that there were supposedly protests and then something sprang out of that, an assault sprang out of that. And that was easily ascertained that was not the fact.
But the American
people could have known that within days, and they didn't know that.
With all due respect, the fact is we had 4 dead Americans. Was it because of a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night and decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make? It is our job
to ascertain that was not the fact.
But the American
people could have known that within days, and they didn't know that.
Hi, Suzette LT here. You can replay this episode or previous episodes by going to blogtalkradio.com/Suzette Live Talk to listen to them in part or whole. Don't forget to tune in next time to Suzette Live Talk for discussion about events and topics big and small. We'll discuss them all. Join me, Suzette LT. Oh my, that just sounds so cheesy. Okay, and we're back. See, that was short. I didn't want to delay it too long because after a while we forget what we're talking about. I know I do sometimes. Okay, so we're back to the Saharan Libyan from the Nubian sandstone aquifer and the project that Omar Gaddafi had in store. So the project had begun in the 1980s. And was entirely funded by the Libyan government. And the U.S.-NATO intervention had been predicated on alleged humanitarian grounds. The so-called responsibility to protect R2P that Samantha Powers favored. But NATO attack planes bombed the pipeline and then struck the factory that produced the pipes. So they first backed it up. So that's great. Now we're going to have planes take it out. Nor were claims of an impending humanitarian disaster based on reality, which was only underscoring sovereignty concerns with the R2P concept. Now reports from the USAID representatives in country, Clinton's advisor Huma Abedin, and even Sidney Blumenthal all agreed that no such threat of a humanitarian disaster existed. Further, diplomats, U.S. military personnel, and human rights organizations all expressed intense skepticism of Obama administration claims that Gaddafi was supplying his troops with Viagra in order to rape women who supported the rebellion against his government. A totally unsupported rumor passed to Clinton by Blumenthal. Dirty dogs. Mm-mm. Rather, it is apparent that the Obama administration decision to announce official support for the Libyan Muslim Brotherhood-led Al-Qaeda militias were based at least in part or more, of the dubious messages Sidney Blumenthal was feeding to Secretary Clinton. For example, on March 9, 2011, Blumenthal wrote in a source comment, possibly from Dumheller. It says, private individuals in Europe with ties to leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood-dominated National Libyan Council plan to urge the NLC military committee to consider hiring private troops, mercenaries, to support, organize, and train the rebel forces in Libya. These individuals believe that NATO and the Western allies will not make a decision to aid the rebels until they are faced with a humanitarian disaster, and that the revolution is in danger. At the same time, these individuals believe a small number of private troops could turn the battle against Gaddafi forces, particularly if they are equipped with sophisticated anti-aircraft weapons. These individuals also believe that experienced troops will have little trouble shooting down Libyan aircraft and attack helicopters. In the opinion of these sources, this would have a devastating psychological effect on Gaddafi troops. End quote. Thus, when on March 19, 2011, Gaddafi forces were advancing on Benghazi, and the revolution that was based there actually seemed in danger of collapse, a humanitarian disaster was declared. In fact, nothing more than the defeat of the Al-Qaeda and Muslim Brotherhood rebels was likely. But that was enough to spur the U.S. and NATO to action by declaring that a catastrophe was in the making. Even though Gaddafi had declared a temporary truce and pulled back from major rebel-held cities, against all apparent reason then, this was the point when Secretary Clinton announced official U.S. government recognition of the jihadist rebel forces. The appointment of Christopher Stevens as envoy to the jihadists, and NATO began bombing Libya. Obviously, these policies were not in response to any real humanitarian crisis, but rather to rescue the jihadist revolution against Muammar Gaddafi. Secretary Clinton's State Department aide Jake Sullivan was not exaggerating when he wrote in August 2011 that Mrs. Clinton had leadership, ownership, stewardship of this country's policy from start to finish. In audio recordings retrieved from Tripoli, a U.S. intermediary from the Joint Chiefs of Staff indicated that Secretary Clinton, State Department controlled what intelligence would be provided to American officials in the lead up to the Libyan intervention. These audio recordings also exposed how Secretary Clinton ordered the Pentagon to refuse to talk to Gaddafi's son, Saif, after the UN Security Council Resolution 1973 to establish a no-fly zone over Libya was passed on March 17, 2011. As the CCB, which is the Citizens Commission on Benghazi, revealed in its first interim report, Gaddafi's regime reached out just days later to retired Admiral Chuck Kubik in order to broker a possible abdication under a white flag of truce with AFRICOM. Although Gaddafi officials successfully made contact with AFRICOM officers under the command of General Carter Ham, who conveyed the possibility of a truce up the chain of command to Washington, the administration chose to nix these efforts. We have now learned that Gaddafi also wanted to make a deal with the British. Despite Gaddafi's multiple attempts at a truce to discuss his possible abdication and exile, however, the U.S. and its partners were determined to intervene militarily in Libya's civil war on the side of Al-Qaeda, a catastrophic mistake that ultimately transformed Libya into an Islamic jihadist safe haven, running guns to Al-Qaeda. Sometime during March 2011, President Obama signed a presidential intelligence finding that authorized U.S. support to the Libyan rebels. It's fair to say that if we wanted to get weapons into Libya, we probably could. We're looking at all our options at this point. President Obama told ABC News at the time, yet at the same time when advisor was counseling Secretary Clinton against arming the rebels. Sending more arms into a society generally, particularly when they are disorganized and fragmented as they are, will result in more violence against each other. Anne-Marie Slaughter, the State Department's Director of Policy Planning, told Secretary Clinton, nevertheless, intervention carried the day, and so Operation Zero Footprint was launched. It was under the military command authority of NATO, not the U.S. military, although Admiral James G. Stavridis was the Supreme Allied Commander Europe at the time. He had replaced AFRICOM Commander General Carter Ham with responsibility for oversight of the Libyan campaign. As its name suggests, the objective of Operation Zero Footprint was to facilitate the covert transfer of weapons to the Libyan rebels without calling attention to the key coordinating role of the U.S., and specifically the Hillary Clinton State Department, which had overall control of the arms transfer. To avoid any concerns over obtaining congressional approval for funding, the United Arab Emirates arranged the financing. Qatar served as the logistics hub and shipping agent. Qatar, isn't that interesting? Who was it that we bargained for Bergdahl? I think it was Qatar. Imagine that. And we had to release five of the prisoners from Guantanamo Bay. How neat this is all panning out. Now, given the abundant reporting available in the open source arena alone, there is no question that Christopher Stevens, appointed official U.S. envoy to the rebels in March 2011, knew that the key leaders of the rebellion whom he was instrumental in arming, such as Abdel Hakim Belhaji, were jihadists. They had a history stretching back to fighting with the Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, and then joining bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri and other top AQ leaders in the Sudan in the early 1990s. Further, the Obama administration and the Clinton State Department knew perfectly well that the Belhajis, Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, renamed the Libya Islamic Movement for Change in February, which he founded upon returning to Libya from Afghanistan in the 1990s, had been an al-Qaeda affiliate since 2007. Indeed, the State Department had already designated the LIFG a foreign terrorist organization on December 8, 2004. Nevertheless, no doubt in possession of the same information and maybe more, the United Kingdom and the MI6 keen to see Muammar Gaddafi assassinated had sheltered and sponsored the LIFG leadership figures, such as the Sami al-Saadi and Abu Anas al-Libi for years. This cannot have been known, or this cannot have been unknown to MI6 partners among the U.S. intelligence community. Captured and imprisoned at Guantanamo Bay. In the wake of the 9/11 attacks, key LIFG figures, including Belhaji and al-Saadi and al-Libi, were all released in 2008-2010 timeframe under Saif Gaddafi's ultimately suicidal reconciliation process. It will be recalled that Stevens served as a deputy chief of mission at the U.S. Embassy in Tripoli from 2007 to 2009, and took an oddly solicitous interest in the welfare of Libyan jihadis detained in Gaddafi's prison. His interest included Abu Safiyan bin Kamu, who would later play a leadership role in the September 12th attack on the special mission compound, where Stevens was killed. Bin Kamu trained at one of bin Laden's terror camps in Afghanistan in the early 1990s, then joined bin Laden in Sudan before returning to Afghanistan pre-9/11 to fight alongside the Taliban. He then fled to Pakistan, was turned over to the U.S., and sent to Guantanamo Bay. Under the terms of his release back to Libya, bin Kamu was imprisoned by Gaddafi until his 2000 release under the reconciliation process. He ultimately rose to commander, command the Ansar al-Sharia element centered in Derna, which was identified as a lead group in a September 2012 attack. As Stevens' own reporting from Tripoli indicated, he was not unaware that Libya were a source of jihadis going to fight U.S. and coalition forces in Iraq. However, he obviously had no clear understanding of Islam or the doctrinal mandate to jihad, and to some extent rather romanticized the Libyan jihadists who later led the 2011 uprising against Muammar Gaddafi and ultimately conspired to murder him. Thus, it is hard to escape the conclusion that senior U.S. military officers, such as U.S. Admiral James Darvidas, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization's supreme allied commander in Europe, were disingenuous at a minimum when they claimed in open Senate testimony in late March 2011 that Islamist fighters were small in number with only a limited role in rebel ranks. They were probably told to. I don't know of any admirals or any military personnel that would do so on their own. What would they have to benefit from it? I don't know. Although there's no evidence directly linking weapons provided to these al-Qaeda jihadists by the Qataris, with U.S. and NATO's explicit approval and assistance to the attack on the SMC in September 2012, it is a certain fact that had the Obama administration not switched sides in what was then called the Global War on Terror, jihadist rebels would have never succeeded in overthrowing the West the West erstwhile ally, Muammar Gaddafi, in the first place. But switch sides they did, for reasons noted at the beginning of this report. A UN Security Council arms embargo was established against Libya on February 26, 2011. Yet Hillary Clinton's State Department, operating under President Obama, presidential directive authorizing covert action to destabilize Gaddafi, including weapons trafficking to the Libyan al-Qaeda-linked jihadis, explicitly violated that arms embargo and approved at least one U.S. weapons shipment to those jihadis. Documents obtained from the burned-out SMC by the Washington Times detail an arms shipment from the Delarian Capital Inc. of Fresno, California, that was to include rocket launchers, grenade launchers, 7,000 machine guns, and 8 million rounds of ammunition. Although the Delarian licensing request was approved by the State Department in spring 2011, it was revoked before the armaments were sent. Now, given that NATO air and sea forces effectively blockaded Libya's Mediterranean coastline from late March 2011 onward, no arms shipments could have gotten through the jihadist rebels unless the U.S. and other NATO powers allowed it. According to the Wall Street Journal, a team of 60 Qataris set up rebel command centers in Benghazi and elsewhere, coordinating their dozens of Western liaison officers who included Americans, British, and French. Together, between April 2011 and the fall of Tripoli in October 2011, they coordinated the delivery of at least 18 cargo planes from Qatar that were filled with assault rifles, rocket-propelled grenade launchers, and other small arms, as well as military uniforms and vehicles. You know, they wanted to make sure they got it all. Leave nothing to chance. Ali al-Salabi, one of the State Department envoy, Christopher Stevens' key al-Qaeda Muslim Brotherhood partners in Benghazi, personally helped to orchestrate at least a dozen of those shipments. One Western diplomat was quoted as saying that everyone was quite happy with the Qatari arms shipments, including the Obama White House and Clinton State Department. It's what everyone wanted to do, but wasn't allowed to do. Of course not. Jeez. Oh, I'm losing my voice. And this is getting good. So Clinton and Stevens understandably kept a low profile on their collaboration with the Libyan jihadists, so that in the end, the only American visibly caught up in the tangled U.S. gun-running operation to the Libyan rebels was an American arms dealer, Mark Turi, head of the Turi Defense Group. He has been charged by the U.S. government with having allegedly falsified paperwork to supply the rebels with weapons, a charge which Turi denies. Instead, Turi alleges he applied for an export license to the United Arab Emirates and Qatar at the same time. At the same time, the U.S. government actually was facilitating weapon deliveries to the rebels. It was then, and remains now, my opinion that the United States did participate directly or indirectly in the supply of weapons to the Libyan Transitional National Council. Former CIA officer and Turi business partner David Manners declared on Turi's behalf in May of 2015. Despite such troubling evidence that Obama and Clinton were deeply and knowingly involved in running guns to al-Qaeda in Libya, when Representative Mike Pompeo, who right now has working for President Trump, anyway, Mr. Representative Mike Pompeo from Kansas asked Clinton a direct question three times during her October 2015 hearing before the Benghazi Select Committee. Quote, were you aware or are you aware of any efforts by the U.S. government in Libya to provide any weapons either directly or indirectly or through a cutout to any militias or oppositions to Gaddafi's forces? She denied it, saying no three times. She was also asked directly by Representative Pompeo whether she had ever considered the idea of using private security experts to arm the opposition in Libya. She denies this too, saying, not seriously, no. After Pompeo quoted her own words back to her from an email Clinton had sent her aide, Jake Sullivan, that read, FYI, the idea of using private security experts to arm the opposition should be considered. She then stepped again, saying it was not considered seriously. There was a final important footnote to the gun-running campaign. In the CCB's April 2014 interim report, we describe the following incident that bears repeating, as it is quite revealing of individuals and groups and their allegiance in the 2011 Libyan Civil War, as we wrote then. After Gaddafi's regime had been ousted, a delegation from the United Arab Emirates traveled to Libya to collect payment for the weapons the UAE had financed and Qatar had delivered to the Transitional National Council during the war. Some of those weapons were diverted, however, as emerged when the UAE came calling to collect payment in January 2012. Quote, the UAE delegation was seeking $1 billion, it claimed, was owed. During their visit to Tripoli, the UAE officials discovered that half of the $1 billion worth of weapons it had financed for the rebels had, in fact, been diverted by Mustafa Abdul Jalalo, the Muslim Brotherhood head of the Libyan TNC, and sold to Gaddafi. Furthermore, according to information learned during the UAE visit to Tripoli, when Jalal learned that Major General Abdel Fattah Yanis, Gaddafi's former minister of the interior before his late February 2011 defection to the rebel forces, had found out about the weapons diversion. He ordered the leader of the Abu Albida, Ben al-Jarara, brigade to kill him. Abu Qatala, later identified as the Ansar al-Sharia commander who led the 11 September 2012 attack on the U.S. mission in Benghazi, accepted the orders and directed the killing of General Yunus in July 2011. Significantly, as we noted at the time, this incident demonstrates that there was a direct chain of command leading from Libya's Muslim Brotherhood leadership at the TNC level down to Abdul Qatala's militia, soon to become part of the newly formed al-Qaeda-linked Ansar al-Sharia group after the war. Captured in June 2014 by members of the U.S. Special Operations Command, Abdul Qatala was indicted for conspiring to attack and destroy U.S. facilities in Benghazi, as well as kill the Department of State and CIA staff at those facilities. Interestingly, as Senior Policy Fellow at the National Review Institute and contributing editor of the National Review, Andrew McCarthy points out in a May 11, 2016 column, the Justice Department decision not to seek the death penalty against Qatala reveals much about the politicization of the Benghazi attack by the Obama administration. For if Qatala is to be charged with helping to coordinate a terrorist attack that resulted in the death of four Americans, then the administration can no longer pretend that the September 11, 2012 incident was merely a protest about a video that spun out of control. Qatala also would be permitted in his own defense to attempt to show that others, al-Qaeda jihadists perhaps, played a bigger role in the attack than he did, and that the Obama administration even contributed to the debacle through its own actions during the 2011 revolution, and materially supporting the very same terrorist who later would attack the mission. A lot of interesting stuff here. Okay. Oh my goodness. Wow. I went way over time. I never got anything from this. Oh, it says that I'm out. Can you guys hear me? Hi, Gunslinger. Are you hearing me? Do you not hear me? If you can hear me. Okay. My board has totally just gone off. Wow, that's really bizarre. There it is. It's back. Wow. That's incredible. Okay. It was a big blank a second ago. Incredible, incredible. All right. So here we are with Obama and Clinton's big hands in everything, which we already knew, but at least we're learning some more details and getting those details confirmed. So Libya's descent into chaos and warnings ignored. After Gaddafi was executed on October 20th, 2011, the Obama administration insisted on maintaining a light footprint in Libya. President Obama, now facing an important re-election campaign in 2012, was desperate to maintain a facade of normalcy and success in Libya, despite a security situation that was deteriorating badly and rapidly. And rather than admit the reality of gathering chaos and al-Qaeda's militias running amok, Obama and Secretary of State allowed a slow attrition of security forces in an increasingly unstable Libya. One second.
Hey, buddy.
Okay. Go there. Sorry about that. My dog was having a needy moment, decided to jump up in my lap, and he's not very light. Oh, my goodness. Yes, it says I have 24 minutes. Thank you. I know. I had no clue. Like I said, my board in the studio here just blank. It just was blank. No callers, not even I showed on the board. Not something. See if I can keep my voice to at least finish this section here in the 24 minutes that we have left. Coming down with this cold, I'm fighting. Oh, terrible. Excuse me. Okay, let's take another short break here. I'm going to get something to drink. It'll be short, and I'll be right back. Okay, back. Much better. Oh, apologize for that brief, unexpected break, especially when we're so short of time. So my sincerest apologies, and we will get back on track. So after then President Obama and then Secretary of State had Gaddafi murdered, basically, in the summarization of words. let's see, the White House had armed, backed, encouraged, and funded the Islamic uprising across North Africa. Indifferent to the actual intent of the jihadis who staged it, which was to eject all Western presence from the region, others pulled out, but the Americans had remained. And now it was their turn. Shortly after the U.S. State Department rented the special mission compound in Benghazi, a group affiliated with the Ansar al-Sharia moved in next door. Yet when the diplomatic staff requested a machine gun and sandbags to fortify the special mission compound, they were told it wasn't aesthetically pleasing and would upset the neighbors, according to Fox News. The intelligence community produced literally hundreds of reports about terrorist militias that had both the capability and the intent to strike the U.S. presence in Libya. There were at least 20 security incidents involving international organizations, including the United Nations, non-governmental organizations like the International Committee of the Red Cross, other diplomats and missions, as well as the SMC itself, during the months leading up to the September 11, 2012 date. Regional Security Officer Eric Nordstrom compiled a list of 234 security incidents in Libya between June 20th and July 2012, 50 of which took place in Benghazi, according to one congressional report. The Red Cross was hit by RPGs in May. Then, in early June, a car bomb exploded outside the hotel where Ambassador Stevens was staying. By June 6th, an IED blew a hole in the special mission compound. A big hole in that perimeter wall. Can you believe that? And still, no help. Days later, the British ambassador to Libya's convoy was hit by RPGs. The British and the Red Cross pulled out of Libya, but America remained. Ambassador Stevens and other State Department officials in Libya made repeated requests for additional security measures, including personnel, especially for the mission, the U.S. mission in Benghazi. We already know that. All were either denied or ignored, and we know that too. When Regional Security Officer Eric Nordstrom requested additional security personnel in March of 2012, including five temporary duty diplomatic security staffers, a State Department employee asked him why Embassy Tripoli wanted the sun, the moon, and the stars, according to the Senate Intelligence Committee. That committee also reported that Mrs. Charlene Lamb, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for International Programs for Diplomatic Security, wow, that's a title, had complained that if security requests were filled, it would be embarrassing and give Libya more security agents than in Yemen and Pakistan. In May 2012, the Undersecretary of State for Management, Patrick Kennedy, turned down a request for Special Forces site security team to retain a DC-3 airplane. According to former Deputy Chief of Mission Gregory Hicks, Kennedy also declined a Department of Defense offer to extend the Special Forces site security team mission in Libya in July of 2012. In accordance with protocol, Ambassador Stevens in turn then subsequently twice refused General Ham's offer for assistance. Lieutenant Colonel Andrew Wood, who commanded those 16 Special Forces men, had pulled out in August of 2012, leaving only five Special Forces men behind. Speaking to a reporter in 2015, LTC Wood recalled that, quote, "They gave us nothing to work with. We had to resource everything we could with what we had in front of us, contracting with the locals, seeking the agency's help, and working with meager internal resources," unquote. According to Wood, State Department officials in Washington had their minds made up. They were not going to provide additional security. Charlene Lamb, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Diplomatic Security, responded to the request that the team be allowed to stay in Libya with no email or with an email. "No," she said. "I do not want them to ask for the military security team to stay." Unquote. When the local landlord who rented the SMC property to the State Department began to express increased concerns for the safety of his family if Americans continued to occupy the property, and even the local Libyan security guards began to worry about showing up for work, these signs should have been indicators about an impending attack or impending attack. Wood tried to warn Stevens and the State Department, but to no avail. Obama and Clinton had decided the State Department's mission in Benghazi would have to fend for itself, and that was that. In all, the Obama administration ignored over 600 requests for security in Libya in 2012, with 83 of those requests coming in July and August. In sharp contrast to her intense involvement in the war to overthrow Gaddafi, Secretary Clinton testified in October 2015 that she didn't see any of the security requests in 2012. Finally, on August 29, 2012, the Libyan government placed the city of Benghazi under a state of maximum alert until further notice due to a sting of attacks on foreigners and other attacks on violence. And according to Libyan Deputy Interior Minister Wanis al-Sharif, who spoke on Libyan TV, there was an emergency plan of action for the SMC that was drawn up by the Department of State's Bureau of Diplomatic Security in late 2011, in the immediate aftermath of the fall of Gaddafi's government. By 2012, however, the security situation on the ground, especially in Benghazi, had deteriorated badly. If anything, circumstances demanded a significant increase in security measures at the SMC. And yet, instead, throughout the year and the months leading up to the September 2012 attack, the State Department consistently downplayed the increasing violence by Islamic terror groups against Westerners and downgraded even what inadequate security measures the SMC had previously had. The question of why has never been adequately pressed or answered. The original emergency plan was based on Ambassador Stevens occupying Villa A rather than Villa C, as he decided to do after Villa A had been turned back to the Libyan owner. Villa C was considered vulnerable because the exterior wall, while more than 10 feet high on the side of the compound, was less than 6 feet high on the outside, due to the slope of the ground. That wall was not topped, as it should have been, with a concertina barbed wire. Further, the interior ground of the compound between that wall and Villa C was covered with vegetation that could provide cover and concealment to any potential attackers who got in over the wall. A vehicle guard were to be positioned at the southwestern wall gate at all times. Additionally, all Americans and all vehicles were equipped with global positioning systems, devices called Blue Force attackers, or Blue Force trackers, not attackers, trackers, that once activated were connected directly to the State Department Bureau of Diplomatic Security in Washington, D.C. The personal devices were kept in go bags, however, and not worn on the person. There is reporting that one of these devices from the SMC was activated that night, was tracked long after to a local mosque in Benghazi, Libya. If there were an attack while the ambassador was inside Villa C, the plan was to move him under cover of a wall of fire to the Tactical Operations Center, which was easier to defend. Then a call would be made for assistance to the CIA annex, where previously designated three members of Global Response Staff would be dispatched immediately to the ambassador's compound. Meanwhile, members of the Diplomatic Security Service at the SMC were to phone the 17 February MARTA's Brigade Quick Reaction Force for help. Repeated drills had trimmed the brigade's response time from its barracks some 1.9 kilometers away down to 7 minutes or less. The brigade included some 45 to 50 men. It is worthy of a note here that on the night of the attack, all of the DSS members' protective gear and weapons were in storage in another building removed from where they were. One of the reasons there was no return fire from DSS defenders at the SMC is that they could not get to the gear and weapons before being overrun. CCB had not been able to determine who gave orders or permitted a situation possibly against standing orders in which DSS agents would be physically separated for any length of time from their weapons, much less on the night of 9/11. One of the Annex GRS team arrived at the SMC. They were to join forces with the DSS personnel and move the ambassador and other Americans out of the compound as rapidly as possible, not to stand and fight. Once at the annex, the next phase of evacuation would have been to the Benghazi airport for exfiltration. If the airport were closed, then the plan was to stay at the CIA annex until U.S. military assets arrived, and then fly out on the Marine Corps helicopter. The SMC DSS agents conducted daily communication checks with AFRICOM to ensure coordination and readiness according to this plan. The last exfiltration fallback, should all else fail, was a road convoy overland eastward to the Egyptian border under protection of a 17 February Martyrs Brigade escort. Their mission in such a case was to arrive as quickly as possible at the SMC, clear any threat, secure the land, and prepare for the exfiltration operation. DSS agents drilled these various scenarios repeatedly with the 17 February Martyrs Brigade members, but in the final analysis, they knew they could not defend the SMC against a serious armed assault. As events unfolded the night of September 11th, 2012, there was no part of this that went according to plan. The CIA annex in Benghazi was far better fortified than the U.S. Special Mission Command, or compound, which is the SMS, or SMC. But it did not operate as a fully clandestine base of operations. The CIA's annex security team, a team of elite former military members who served under the CIA's then secretive global response staff, traveled with the CIA case officers when they went into Benghazi proper. According to the annex security team, authors of the book 13 Hours, the inside account of what really happened in Benghazi, one contractor realized that they weren't fooling anyone. Even as a casual observer would have noticed the tight security, not to mention the carloads of Americans driving in and out day and night. In an anonymous episode that the GRS team understood was indicative of these things to come. Team members were stopped in the summer of 2012 by heavily armed contingent of Libyans. They believe were members of the Anwar Anwar al-Sharia. When they called for backup, CIA Chief of Base Bob told them that the February 17 Martyrs Brigade would assist them. They never came. By 2012, alarm had risen everywhere about the quantity and quality of weapons in which Libya was now awash. The shipments of arms from Qatar and elsewhere had only added to the enormous stockpiles of Gaddafi's weapons that had been looted during and after the 2011 revolution. Of particular concern, there were many thousands of surface-to-air missiles that had gone missing, among them large numbers of MANPADs, man-portable air defense systems, guided missiles capable of bringing down aircraft. One of the principal purposes for maintaining the CIA annex after the revolution was to attempt to recover as many of these dangerous weapons as possible through Libyan cutouts, buy them up off the market for $125,000 to $150,000 each, and ship them out of Libya. Two Libyan shipping companies handled the weapon shipments, the Al-Bahar and the Al-Muda Wasat, Mediterranean Shipping Agency, with headquarters in Benghazi, Libya. And the Mediterranean Shipping Company out of Tripoli. So it looks like there were a lot of people in cahoots here that sacrificed for our Americans. One of which knew their fate, possibly, and that's the ambassador, since he was sort of mixed up in this. Sort of, I say, because he had a mission that was working alongside a mission, unbeknownst to him. And that's a shame. Again, there's 78 pages to this report. We got through 30 of them this evening, if you can believe that. It's a good read in the sense that it puts a lot of pieces of puzzles to make one big picture. One that some may not want to know about. Others, I think you may feel comforted in knowing exactly what happened. And the fact that this person, Ms. Clinton, is not continuing everything here, you know, as far as the dirty works. I got a lot of comments here. Let's see. In the chat room. Oh. Gunslinger. Okay, you guys are talking about the weather and where you grew up. I see. Cool. Cog says, oh, bummer, and Killary needed to be deified, final, yes. Definitely. Oh, I'm going to have to read these after I'm finished the end here. Thank you, everybody, for showing up tonight. It's wonderful to hear you. Check out the report. I put the link into the chat room. Have a wonderful evening. Have a wonderful weekend. Take care.
Let's see. What key was that again? Oh, yeah.
Suffer from chronic CFED or can't focus energy drain? Try over-the-counter Vibrin. One tablet contains the same caffeine as a cup of coffee, but without the calories or coffee breath. Vibrin. Caffeine, not coffee. Taking Vibrin may result in increased productivity and decreased dread in setting alarms. Unexpected enjoyment of the graveyard shift has been associated with Vibrin. Vibrin may be a better budget option than drinking coffee. It may also decrease the urge to doze off, skip work, or exhibit signs of slacking. All jokes aside, always read the label, take only as directed, and limit caffeine as it may cause real side effects. Not for children under age 12. Do you you suffer from chronic CFED or can't focus energy drain? Try over-the-counter Vibrin. One tablet contains the same caffeine as a cup of coffee, but without the calories or coffee breath. Vibrin, caffeine, not coffee. Taking Vibrin may result in a lack of drowsiness, improved productivity, and better cash flow from decreased coffee spending. Unexpected job promotions have been associated with Vibrin. Vibrin may decrease the urge to zone out, doze off, or exhibit signs of slacking. All jokes aside, always read the label, take only as directed, and limit caffeine as it may cause real side effects. Not for children under age 12.